Welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric B.
Today we are joined by our friend Andrew. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty well. How about you?
Doing well. Where are you from?
Columbia, Maryland.
Columbia, Maryland.
Wow, another one.
Another
Jesus
Columbia.
Fucking Christ, man.
Yes. When were you first introduced to recovery?
I was probably introduced to recovery 2011, 2012. Yeah.
All right. And how long have you been clean?
A little less than 3.5 years at this point.
All right. Well, good for you, man. And with all that out of the way, it's not much out of the way. But yeah, we're going to turn it over to you, buddy. Share your story with us.
All right. So I guess my story begins like back in Columbia, like every other Columbia person. Grew up in a good family, had like a good nuclear family, not really drugs or alcohol present. Pretty successful, athlete, school, everything like that. I did really well.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really have any trouble with stuff like that. Just I did a lot of sports and did a lot of like school activities to try and fit in. School was really easy for me. Sports were really easy for me. I was able to like hold my own in all that regard. Did really well in school.
That's a solid humble brag right there.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to like set up a nice little background for
okay.
you. But what I struggled was I was socially inept going from like elementary school, middle school. So when I started high school, because I had gone to school, with the same crew through, elementary school and middle school, but my set neighborhood was, the only neighborhood from my middle school to go to this separate high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I decided I wanted to kind of start over. Like, I had screwed up in middle school, did some stupid stuff. Start over in high school, do my best to try and be one of the cool kids, try and fit in, play a lot of sports.
Yep.
I'd always played a lot of sports and just did that, that type of thing, but I really made an effort to try and fit in with a good crowd, and
mm-hmm.
But that good crowd involved a lot of drinking, and so to be honest with you, I drank, and I was kind of a weekend warrior in high school. We did a lot of parties. I loved going to high school parties. It was the way to meet girls. Is you get drunk,
yeah,
you got a chance of actually hooking up in high school. Stuff like that made me feel cool.
Yeah,
made me feel part of the crowd when you were invited to these parties.
Do you remember what your first drink was?
Oh, yes, I do. It Ooh. Was, we stole a bottle of Cavassier from my parents' liquor
cabinet.
Oh,
my God.
And it was me and a bunch of guys, actually, that I went to, elementary school and middle school with that we drank a bunch of it and passed out in the downstairs living room of my parents' house and woke up and one of them puked all over the couch, and my parents knew from, the get-go.
Your parents had Cavassier?
They had a bottle of it that they got as a gift probably in 1985 and just had never opened, never touched it.
Yeah, nothing that like makes that. Sense.
And so it was really interesting doing that. But so I didn't mind drinking. Drinking was a social aspect to me. I liked pushing the envelope when I was in high school. But what I really loved is smoking weed. But for some reason, I thought my greatest ambition was to play college soccer. So I was I can't smoke during seasons because I did soccer, wrestling, and lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
So I was I can't smoke during seasons. So during the 2 weeks in between seasons in the summer, I just got absolutely high as shit every single day with a bunch of guys. And then as soon as the season started, I'd be all right, well, I can't smoke anymore. I got focused on sports
because mm-hmm.
that's where my 5-foot self was going to excel in.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed smoking weed. I really liked it. And I really just partied a lot in high school on the weekends, stuff like that, to the point and most normal people don't get this, is my junior year of high school for New Year's Eve night, we somehow got invited to college, a group of college kids that had graduated 2 years before us
mm-hmm.
that we had known were coming back and rented out a bunch of hotel rooms for New Year's Eve.
Oh, hotel parties.
And
yes.
It was a hotel party, and I was a junior in high school, and I went to this college party. I was I can keep up with all you guys. And ended up going to the hospital that night.
Yep.
Nice little BAC of 0.38, and just did... Lovely. My parents actually, when they my friends had they talked to my friends as they drove them, they were just bring him home next time. Don't bring him to the hospital. There's no point. There's nothing you can do. So my parents were just bring him home, put him on the front porch, we'll take care of him.
Wow.
So they kinda the very good Irish Catholic way swept things under the rug. They didn't want people to know.
Yeah.
They didn't, this was our nuclear problem, and boys will be boys.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you party hard. And my parents knew I was smoking weed. Like, it was blatantly obvious.
Yeah.
The first time I'd ever smoked weed, we smoked weed at this guy's house I was playing lacrosse with, and his mom caught us. And she was like, all right, whatever, it's fucking weed. But
yeah.
She drove us home. But I didn't want my parents to find out, like, why are you being dropped off at, like, 2 a.m.?
Yeah.
So I called my parents and was like, Mom, Dad, like, some guy came in here, he smoked weed, and he tried to peer pressure me, like, I need you to come get me. And, like, I'm high as hell. And my dad's not stupid. My dad, like, went to school, went to college. He's not an idiot. Like,
yeah.
He has plenty of stories from UMass. And he's just, I come home reeking like weed, and I, like, crawl. And I was just like, I don't know, this guy just tried to make me smoke weed. And my parents were like, okay, Andrew, just go to bed.
That's ridiculous.
So along the same lines, I was like I started off very early trying to lie and trying to hide it. Like, I was a liar. And I think, like, one of the things when I look back at it is, like, when you try and figure out how do you determine an addict early on, I try and think about, like, looking at lying behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, like, one of the things, because one of my things I'm really interested in is psychology, is what are the psychological assessments you can do, like, early on in a person's life to determine, like, are they more predisposed to become an addict
in
their life? And one of the things that I notice when people tell their stories in the 12-step programs, or when I hear it when I was in rehab or stuff like that, is, like, they all started out, like, exaggerating and lying from a very early age.
Mm.
Like, not, like, normal kid exaggerating and lying, but they would take it far and beyond.
Yeah.
And so it's something that always interested me. So high school, really easy, did schoolwork, did athletic, and I was able to get a scholarship and go play soccer up in a D3 school up in upstate New York.
Nice.
And I really enjoyed high school, so I went to, like, a smaller type college because I like the small atmosphere. I like being a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
Rather than, like,
mm-hmm.
a small fish in a big pond. And so I enjoyed going up there. I had a great time. My first year, I played soccer, and then I played club lacrosse. And my first season of club lacrosse, I actually ended up getting really injured with my knee. And it was a really bad injury. I basically shattered my meniscus, which is the cartilage in between your two knees.
Ooh,
and it
God.
Took a couple surgeries to fix.
Yeah.
It was, like, in 13 different pieces. They had to, like, normally if you tear it, they just cut it out. But this one, they actually had to piece it back together and put it in the knee and, like, hold it with anchors. So it took a couple surgeries. So for about an entire year, I was dependent. I wouldn't even say dependent. I was given painkillers. Like,
yeah.
They literally put me on painkillers for an entire year while I did rehab. I wasn't allowed to move my knee or take it out of this, like, locking brace for 3 straight months after the surgery so the anchors could set.
Oof.
And so you get really bored. I played a lot of video games. I did, and I took a lot of painkillers. And that's kind of where it started. And one thing that I learned when I went away to college is I went away to college with these, a bunch of, like, I don't know how to describe it. Like, my good friends in college were all, like, New England prep boys. They all went to prep school. They all came from families with a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So they all knew from the get-go how to snort and crush up Percocets and painkillers. They're like, why are you swallowing them? There's this amazing way to take them. Like, what are you doing, you idiot?
Nice.
And they're like, this is awesome. So I started out, like, smoking weed with them all the time during my freshman year. I found out it didn't affect my soccer performance. I could actually smoke weed all the time, and it didn't affect my school performance. So while in high school, I split it up in between seasons and summer. By the time I reached my freshman year of college, I went through my first soccer season. I didn't really smoke. I drank a lot because it was, like, first time out on your own.
Yeah.
And then once soccer season ended, I found out all these soccer guys, as soon as the season ended, you can't get drug tested anymore. They fucking smoke weed
all the time. You got drug tested in college for sports?
Yeah.
Even D3?
Yeah, the school tested us. And so then I found out then everyone kind of smokes weed.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. So I smoked weed like 24/7. And this was before I injured my knee. So we were smoking weed like all the time. I was going to class all the time smoking weed, and I didn't see any like noticeable difference. I was able mm-hmm. to smoke weed. I was able to get my same good grades to keep my scholarship. I was able to still go to all my soccer, still run as fast as I could, and I just didn't notice any noticeable difference. So it just increased. I enjoyed going to class high. I enjoyed waking up high. I enjoyed keeping a grab bong by my bed. And it's just like all the different things that you like couldn't do when you were living at your parents' house, I was enjoying doing. So yeah, then I injured my knee, and that was like wasn't the best time because everything.
Is there a best time to injure your knee?
No, but my entire identity when I was at college, when I went to college, was being an athlete.
Yeah,
and this type of injury that I was out for an entire year. That means I was missing my sophomore season, and they didn't know whether I was going to be able to come back.
Yeah.
And I actually ended up never making it back to varsity. I played around, but I never really made it back to the level that I was. I never really made it back, like, as a starter or anything like that after this knee injury. So I spent 12 months, like, multiple surgeries rehabbing this knee. And my best drug dealer was my orthopedic surgeon. Mm-hmm. He literally every 30 days just kept it going.
Yep.
And on top of that, I learned lovingly through college, because at this point in time, I was going through a very dark time. It was my sophomore year of college. I had lost my identity because I was on the sideline, like, watching my friends play soccer, which is what I love to do.
Did, like, depression, like, come in at that point?
Yeah. And so I talked to the team doctor and the psychiatrist at the college there and stuff like that, and their solution was prescribing me 120 Xanax every month.
Oh, God.
Wonderful.
So I was now snorting Percocet, taking a shitload of Xanax, and drinking to oblivion on top of all that.
Yeah.
My sophomore year was a time that I really, like, there were a lot of blackouts in play because I was drinking on Xanax. I was making a lot of stupid decisions. My grades were suffering because I was drinking so much, and that was my thought pattern. It's like, oh, my drinking is the reason why my grades suck.
Mm-hmm.
Not my drug use, it's my drinking. Yeah. Because I'd wake up and I'd feel awful, I wouldn't be able to do anything the next day. Like, and I just handled it really, like, by trying to forget. I delved into a lot of psychedelics that year. We still smoked weed. Like, weed is literally a constant through my story, especially in college. I literally smoked weed every hour throughout the day. And at that point, I finished the surgeries with my orthopedic surgery. I was back up at school. My pill supply was running out, and my money supply was running out. So I would, at this point, I kind of reverted to get them when you could. Yeah. A lot of times, me and my buddies, of course, sophomore year, you got to pick your roommates and stuff like that. So I lumped in with guys who like snorting Percocets with me.
Yeah.
And so then we would take times like faking injuries. Like, we had lacrosse players, soccer players, stuff like that to try and keep a Percocet going. But when you have three or four guys trying to snort Percocets over the weekend, you can't really get a steady supply. Like, there's unless you're buying it, and we're all in college, we're not really working. We're all there on mommy and daddy's dime.
Yep.
So it became like a kind of every once in a while type thing. But then we delved into, like, we smoked pot all the time. Mm-hmm. We took a bunch of ecstasy. We did psychedelics this year. Like, there were some just crazy trips. And we drank. But this year, kind of things, like, kind of fell off. It was my first time I actually saw, like, kind of consequences from my drug and alcohol use, because my grades slipped. And so, based on the scholarship that I had to stay above a 3.5, or I lost, and I had, like, a 75% scholarship to this 60 grand a year school. And so, it fell below a 3.5 that sophomore year.
Yeah.
Parents were not happy with me at all, because they were ponying up the rest of it.
Yeah.
And the school costs a whole lot of money. So, at that point in time, I was like, all right, my drinking's the problem. So, basically, from sophomore year on, I didn't drink. Like, I drank, but I didn't drink. I didn't party hard. I didn't get wasted. I didn't black out, I think since that sophomore year. Well, black out on alcohol. Let's put it that way. I didn't black out on alcohol since that sophomore year. And then once I cut out alcohol, I could smoke weed 24/7. I could basically just play video games, work on my schoolwork, smoke weed, and snort Percocets. When I did go out, I'd snort Adderall and smoke weed, and that's what I like to do. I didn't really like drinking. I'd have a beer or so like that, but when you're putting all those substances in your stomach and you add alcohol on top, your stomach tends to get kind of upset. So I didn't really like that feeling.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So then I basically the rest of college, I got my grades back up. I graduated, like, cum laude. I graduated near the top of my class. I had honors, and I graduated 2 bachelors and a minor. I did really well in school, and immediately from school, I kept smoking weed, and I went right into grad school back closer at home at one of the top universities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went right back into grad school. I graduated in May. I was in grad school in June, and I started that summer semester. I was studying clinical psychology there.
Nice.
So I was studying that, and then come September, I actually started a job where I was actually a gym teacher at a special ed school. And at this point in time, I had a second, or at this point in time, because I had already had the second one, this was a third knee surgery. I had to get stuff cleaned up. The anchors were getting messed up.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a third knee surgery, back on Percocets. It was lovely. Mm-hmm. So I'm going 40 hours of work, 40 hours a job per week at this job, teaching like these inner city youth who had been kicked out of public school and had to go to this private school. Then I was in school, in grad school, like every night from basically 6 until 9, Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing Percocet this entire time. And this is when it really kicked off, because basically that schedule did not allow me to do like really anything but take drugs, go to school, go to work. Smoked a lot of weed. I was living at my parents' house at that point, so the weed kind of dropped off, so the Percocets kind of dropped off. And at this point, I also had connections from high school where I could buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I had a full-time job, I was making a lot of money working at a private school, or a lot of money for someone who was 22 years old.
Yeah.
And paying no rent because I was living at home.
Yeah.
That I basically spent it all on a bunch of Percocets from people I was buying from. And so at this point,
those fuckers are expensive.
Yeah, dollar per milligram.
Mm.
So at this point, my habits started to increase. Like before, I was able to like maintain it like kind of within the doctor's prescription guidelines, like maybe double, but not like what it eventually became. And this is the point where I started going beyond like what daily recommended dosage was, and really started like upping my Percocet dosage, because I found this is what gave me energy. This is the entire, like, burst of speed. Mm. Like, it enabled me to go the 12, 16 hours every single day to get my degree, to work hard. And it was semi-sustainable for a time. I got in with a little wrong crowd. We started taking a lot of Molly. There's actually one period in time that I actually took Molly every single day for the month. And the previous 3 months after that, Jesus, I felt like Christ. Death. Like, I've never been closer to dying than the 3 months after that.
Oh, God, your brain was fucked.
Yeah, but that month long was great. Was it?
I don't know.
I had a good time.
Whoa. For, like, the first week, man. Yeah. Like, and then, like, all the chemicals in your brain have just been flushed out.
Yeah, no, it was the come downs that really sucked. The last week was really bad, but I had like a bunch of schoolwork due, so I couldn't stop taking it.
Oh yeah,
so you
were stuck at that.
You did schoolwork on fucking Molly.
I was teaching kids on Molly.
Oh God.
A small doses, but yeah.
Okay. Well,
maybe small doses.
That's not okay. All right.
Maybe like a one or two caps a day.
Oh wow.
But so I was doing that, and I really enjoyed Molly for that. Never taking Molly again after that month-long period, though.
I should hope not.
But because the next 3 months, I literally felt like the most depressed I've ever felt in my entire life.
Oh, yeah.
And also, constantly through this, I was taking Percocet another time. And then during this time, I proceeded to injure my shoulder. Obviously, teaching inner-city kids, there tend to be fights, and I decided to get in the middle of one.
You're not a big guy.
No, I'm not a big guy.
They were probably just as tall as you, weren't they?
Yeah, no, they were like 6'4". These are like, so the school that I was teaching at has kids up to 21.
Oh, shit.
Because, like, that's the certificate program. It's not like.
Yeah.
So, like, I got in the middle of the fight. I messed up my shoulder. It got dislocated, torn labrum. And so, into surgery again. And I can't tell you, like, how happy I was to injure my shoulder and get surgery. I got workman's comp. I got free Percocets like all the time. But this point in time, like, my brain was so warped and so distorted that I was happy I was injured. I was happy that I had such a significant injury that I knew that I would be able to get Percocets all the time. And also, by this time, my parents were aware of my problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard not to know the problem when they're seeing, like, I'm making so many thousands of dollars and nothing's in my bank account. And I've like 5 credit cards.
Yeah.
Like, they know what's going on.
Yeah.
So, at this point in time, it was my first kind of introduction. We went, So also during this time, I got arrested twice for weed possession. Never got pill possession, surprisingly enough. But so once was in college when I was back at home, Howard County Police.
Of course.
They just kind
of
dropped it because they didn't really, like, I did, like, so yeah, while I was in college, this is actually a funny story. So I was in undergrad. So my freshman year back at, I think it was February break, me and my buddy get caught smoking weed.
Mm-hmm.
I would spend the night in jail. It's so stupid for smoking weed. And, like, it's just...
Yeah.
I was annoyed at all get out. So I come back home, blah, blah, blah. So obviously I got the charge pending. So my dad, being my dad and trying to protect me, hires like a murder attorney for like this weed charge. He's like the top attorney in Colombia. And like along is like the thing that he advertises in is how he beat like these murder charges for this guy.
Wow.
And I'm just like, Dad, what are you doing? So he hires this attorney. His attorney goes in, and of course he's like golf buddies with the judge. And this is Colombia for you.
Yeah,
and
this is Colombia.
This is like kind of, this is a very significant pattern in my story.
And you're from like a richer part of Colombia too. Like,
yeah.
Me, not so much.
Yeah, so this is, I'm like the Colombia Elka City border. So this is like, this is a very, and this is one of the things that we had to address with my dad, and specifically my dad, but my parents in general, is the enabling, is because a very common thread through my story is I would get in trouble. I would get bailed out. I wouldn't have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens. So the judge goes in, talks to my attorney. Attorney gets the null pros as long as I do like this weekend at Columbia Addiction Center. So,
oh, yeah.
So
Eric's been there.
Oh, shit. Too. Yeah.
I've been there.
That was number one. That was the first
time. Yeah, so,
that was
the first. Yeah. So listen, I
went there three times.
I do that. And I'm so good at manipulating these guys and like doing what I have to do. I turned that into an internship next summer. The nice. Following wow. summer after that, wonderful. I was actually an intern there. I had to have an internship for my program for psychology. And I knew
that's pretty awesome.
And that too. So I turned one summer being a patient there into an internship the following summer.
That's talent.
And it comes back full circle. I ended up being a patient of the doctor there. And that's where the Suboxone started.
Mm.
So I went back there and I didn't ever go back into a program. But I went back there to go see the addiction doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where Suboxone started. And this doctor was not the brightest doctor like most Suboxone doctors are. They just want your check for $300 and mm-hmm. get your Suboxone, talk mm-hmm. to him for about 10 minutes and get out of there.
Yep.
So I ended up talking to him and getting stuff like that. So that's after the shoulder surgery, that's like kind of what my parents noticed. And they wanted me like to, if they were going to continue supporting me and like helping me with money, because they were paying for my grad school at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And they were continue supporting me. They wanted me to get help to get, so I was like, all right, whatever. I'll go back to Columbia Addiction Center.
Yeah.
I'll go see the psychiatrist. And mm-hmm. he like recommended like Buddhist prayer and Suboxone. And
Buddhist prayer and Suboxone
So at this point, he was like a member of a Buddhist temple.
Okay.
Like, and so he teach me chants. He's like, you should really come with me. Like, this is really, there's like levels you have to obtain. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy really liked me for some weird reason. And so I build a relationship with this guy, and he keeps giving me Suboxone.
I think I know what guy you're talking about.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
He's the only, And so I keep building a relationship with this guy. He keeps giving me Suboxone, which I keep getting in a Ziploc bag and trading it for Percocets when I get back home from people. And at one point in time, I actually, this was after I'd already injured my shoulder. I had ran out of Percocets that the orthopedic surgery gave me. I showed up there in my shoulder sling. It was just like, listen, like my insurance won't let me get Percocets, like my painkillers, like my shoulder's really messed up. This doctor, who is an addiction psychiatrist, proceeded to write me a prescription for Percocets.
Wow.
Yeah. Wait, the doctor who's prescribing you Suboxone wrote you a prescription for Percocets?
Because I told him there was a mess up with my billing and my insurance. Like I had this whole like plan worked out.
Wait, but doesn't he know he's prescribing you Suboxone?
Yeah, he knows I'm an opiate addict.
Well, but he's also prescribing you Suboxone. But then he's like, oh, here's also some Percocets.
Because I couldn't take the Suboxone when my shoulder was injured. And I couldn't go to my orthopedic surgeon because my insurance wouldn't let me. And there was this whole thing.
It was lying.
Yeah, it was lying. Yeah. And then the guy cared about me. And I
was used your arm legit in a sling or were you faking it for that?
No, this was like before the surgery, but after my shoulder. So
okay.
I injured my shoulder, but the doctor gave me so many Percocets. So obviously, we're gone in like 2 days.
Yeah.
And then I had surgery scheduled like next week, the following week. I was out of Percocet, I was fiending.
Yeah.
And so I had an appointment with this guy, so I showed up in this big sling that I really didn't need at that point. I couldn't hurt it any worse.
Like, yeah.
It was already screwed. I was already having surgery.
It was optics, though, right?
Like, yeah. I made it look really good. I came in. I gave a little teary-eyed speech. Like, nice. Have a, my insurance is screwed. Like, I'm in so much pain. I can't sleep. I can't eat. So he prescribed me Percocet.
Wow.
And this addiction psychiatrist who's been prescribing me Suboxone prescribed me Percocet. And that's like kind of like, there's also another period later on that I did the same thing to a doctor who prescribed me outpatient counseling for opiate addiction. I proceeded to go back to, and she prescribed me Percocet. But that was only a general practitioner. That's not as bad as the addiction psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like, I was a manipulator. I was a liar. I was a manipulator. Yeah. I did what I had to do to get it. Mm-hmm. And that point in time, I was holding a pretty hefty habit.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after the shoulder surgery, I go back in, workers' comp. I finish up that year. I'm still doing really well in school, in grad school. But during that time, people started noticing at like work that I was kind of like falling asleep at my desk. And like, they couldn't prove anything because I was always kind of smart that if they did drug test me, I had a prescription for Percocet. So, yeah. Like, wait, if I came up for it, what are they going to say?
Yeah.
Like, and they kind of knew that, so I got laid off at the end of the year. So I got laid off. They kind of told me why I was getting laid off, the suspicions of it. But at that point in time, I'd already finished my master's. I was going on to get the license.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do a full year of internship anyway, so I couldn't really work.
Yeah.
So I was doing an internship at like a, this is a sick part. I was doing an internship like at a family and children like a counseling center. I was doing counseling with families and children, and in between like the clients and stuff like that, I would actually end up snorting Percocets and thus being high as shit the entire day.
Oof.
And this is where my addiction really skyrocketed. My intake went up. My tolerance started growing like crazy because I've learned this is like the physical dependent portion.
Yeah.
And where it really became bad. So, and this time I was also living with these group of guys that were dealing weed. So it made my weed smoking a lot easier. I constantly smoked weed. Went through like all of that and I actually ended up getting kicked out of their house because I stole a shitload of weed and money from them and used it to pay Percocets, buy Percocets. And they kind of caught on that it was me.
Yeah.
And they basically told me, like, get out or we're going to kick your ass. Like, and I'm not a big guy, and these guys were. And they basically said, you're going to pay us back our money or, like, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the mom and dad. They wrote them a check. I told them the truth.
Shut the fuck up.
I told them the truth. I said I took a bunch of weed and money from them, but I thought it was cool. Like, I thought we were sharing it all, and now they're pissed off at me, and they're threatening me.
Wow.
And so I went, like, listen.
That's amazing.
And the crazy part about this, right, during this time currently, we were at the beach, because we went to the beach every summer, my family, and I had to tell my parents this. They're like, all right, whatever, we'll, like, pay it off. I'm actually taking addiction psychology at that point in time, and I'm getting an A in it. So I'm taking this at one of the top universities, getting an A in it, and I still can't comprehend. See, I have such a preconceived notion that, like, an addict is a gutter rat. It's someone living under, like, a bridge, like, panhandling, stuff like that. I had no comprehension that, like, I could be an addict. Look, my grades are perfect. I have literally hit every goal I've ever set for myself. I'm not happy with myself. I've never been really like before this process of recovery started, truly happy with myself. But like I was, and for all intents and purposes, from the outside, I look like a successful person. Like, continue hitting goals. I've like not only done college, I've done grad school. I'm in these amazing universities. My grades are perfect. I'm playing. Also, at that point, I was playing like semi-pro soccer in the Maryland Major League, just like messing around. And I was playing, like, actually really well, but I was high as hell, like, every day. It was kind of, like, crazy. And I was playing, like, all these guys. And it was actually a straight African team and then me. I'm not joking, but they were all Nigerian, and I played with them. And I
started, none of you can see Andrew right now, but he is one of the whitest people you will ever meet.
Yeah, so basically this is entire Nigerian. So we were sponsored by this, like, Nigerian church. So that's the way it is. And so before our game, before our games were on Sundays in this Maryland Major League. So before the game, we actually had to go to the Nigerian church for them to pray around us. And we had to sit through the whole mass in the full Nigerian, like, traditional outfit.
Did you wear, like, a dashiki?
Yes.
Shut the fuck
up. All of us had to.
Oh, my dope. This is amazing.
So before we had to, and I'm high as hell in this, and they're beating drums, and they're dancing around us.
Dude, praying, that must have been fucking awesome.
Praying for our success. Like, praying for our success on the soccer field. And I'm high as hell right now. Like, I have to, like, go out to the car. I snort Percocets in the car. And go back in, and I'm high as hell playing this game and stuff like that. And it's like, oh my, it was such an interesting story, like, having to, like, go through that. And eventually, like, the team, I just, like, kind of felt, I just stopped showing up. That's kind of the...
Oh my, why would you stop showing up?
I just kind of, well, I played, like, a couple seasons with them, and I just stopped showing up because at that point, like, I didn't really want to work out anymore. I just really wanted to get high and
play video games. Of course, yeah.
So that's kind of, like, where we were at there. And I'm trying to think. So, also, another funny story.
That's amazing.
I was towards the end of my using, probably about a couple years before I ended using, I was actually part of the NASA Soccer League as well. And so they play on the Goddard Space Center, like, right down there.
Good God.
And so every single time I'd have to sneak drugs under, because you had to be escorted on. You can't go on. Like, so I was like, every single week I was sneaking these drugs on to go play with these, like, guys. Stuff like that. And I'd be, like, inside the NASA Space Center, like, snorting drugs. And
wow.
All because, like, and I would just continually do this. And it's just, everywhere I went, I had to. When I was in grad school, I'm at this top university, and literally in bathroom breaks, I would go back to the bathroom. I would snort drugs in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. I would come back. I would snort Percocets. So by the end of it, my last semester there, you have to have 60 graduate credits to graduate with your license.
Mm-hmm.
I had 56. My last two classes were there, a 3-credit and a 1-credit class. I stopped showing up.
Mm-hmm.
I had 56 credits. I stopped showing up. Literally my last semester. Everything is really bad. I just stopped showing up. I'm like, I'm done. Like, I don't even know. I don't even think I made a decision to stop showing up. I was just like, I just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
So at this point, I lost my teaching job. I basically stopped showing up for the grad school that means so much to me. I've really stopped playing soccer. I played, like, every now and then. I was doing, like, a part-time job working with autistic kids to do, like, behavioral analysis. And my Percocet addiction has gotten so bad that in the last, like, 3 months, I'd racked up over $50,000 in cash advances on my credit cards. So I'm now $50,000 in cash advances on my credit cards. I at 21% interest. I have no job prospects. I haven't finished grad school. I just got my Fs. I have no job. I'm living in my parents' house at this point in time. And I was done. I've been kicked out of 3 different IOP programs up to this point. Constantly been going back to IOP, going back to IOP. Like, and it just didn't work for me. I'll be good for those 2 hours. I'll say whatever you want for those 2-3 hours a day.
Yeah, of course.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, I'll say whatever you want. I'll sing that song, but I'll keep coming back and failing those drug tests.
Yep.
Because you want to know what, the rest of those hours, like, I don't have any support. So at this point in time, I also have a cousin. Well, it's my mom's cousin, so my second cousin was 35 years clean and was in a 12-step program.
Mm-hmm.
He comes down at my parents' request and takes me out to, like, a step group where they go over, like, the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes me out to a couple different, like, 12-step meetings. I'm there. I'm on Suboxone. I'm kind of, at this point, I'm doing the Suboxone opiate 2-step.
Yeah.
Going back and forth, depending on what I have. And so we're going to these 12-steps. And I'm like, ah, whatever. Like, I hear what they're saying. So this is my first introduction to 12 steps.
Yeah.
I hear what they're saying. And my uncle's like, or my cousin's just like, reach out to talk to them. So I'm going to a 12-step meeting and I'm reaching out to them. And this fellowship isn't very tolerant on maintenance drugs. And I tell them, like, listen, like, yeah, I'm having trouble with opiates, but I'm on Suboxone right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a tirade spike too. So I was like, all right, well, they don't want me here. Screw that. I didn't want to be here anyway. So gave me a perfect excuse to just stroll right out the door.
Yeah.
And my cousin went back to work in New York. And at that point in time, I told my parents I was going. I was going like once a week to these 12-step meetings. I was high. I was sitting in the back. I wasn't really doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I spent my time just... I'd go in between Suboxone and opiate, Suboxone, opiate, Suboxone, opiate. Really, whenever I, like, did money, I did stupid things to get money. Like, I opened up a Best Buy credit card, and because I could claim my income from a couple years ago when I was making a lot of money, I got big credit limits on these. So I'd go to Best Buy, buy an iPad brand new, go to GameStop, sell it back used within, like, an hour. And so I'd be selling these brand new iPads as used at GameStop just so I could get the $200 in cash. And go use to pick up drugs. So I was doing a bunch of stuff. So, like, really when it came down to it, like, and one of the first, like, lines in the sand that I, like, really started to notice that, like, preconceived notions is that you do not have to be a panhandler to be an addict. You don't have to be, like, a bottom gutter person to be an addict. Around this point in time, I really started noticing that, like, I'm an addict. This is where I really started believing it because of the things I was doing. I could not stop. I didn't want to use. I was engaged at this point in time, too. That fell through. She was a drunk. I was an addict. Didn't work out very well. So I had engagement, breakup. I constantly had girlfriends throughout the period of time and one fiance. And so during this whole period of time, I really... The engagement didn't work out. She was working full time. I was a bum and living at, like, at home. And this was, like, before, like, I moved back to my parents' house. Because obviously when she... We just ended up splitting up because she was drunk and I was high.
Yeah.
And I moved back home. At one point in time, I was just like, screw it, you're messing with my high, I'm going.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Got a little cold going on. So, I moved back home. The engagement's broken off. I had spent the time, like... It was really bad. Basically, everything has gone down the hill. And finally, my parents basically... They knew I was done. They just didn't know. They brought up inpatient to me in the past, and I've always been like, no, like, I'm not that type of addict. Like,
yeah.
I'm fine. So...
I'm dying over here.
I know. It's really just a tickle in my throat. So my parents finally, like, I moved back home, my engagement was done, I've been living at home for a while, I've been still doing that part-time job, but my debt's going up because I'm literally just taking out cash advances, credit cards for Percocets, and I, at this point in time, also, I got a trust fund turned over to me when I was 25.
Good God.
So, I go through about 50 grand in about 2 months or so in trust fund. Just wipe it out.
Wow.
And my parents couldn't do anything because it was in the trust fund, like, stipulations. It got fully turned over to me at 25. And I still had more in there, and I was just racking up credit card debt. My dad finally, like, called on, found a loophole, took it away from me. I couldn't touch it again.
Nice.
Which That's was good. Probably for the best.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm living at my parents' house. I'm literally just eating, like, two blueberry Eggo waffles, like, every other day. Coming downstairs only, like, in the evening time and just staying up to, like, 5 a.m. watching ID Channel. And literally, like, all night watching ID Channel. I'm not even joking. Like, it was so bad to this point that my fiancé now, who met me a couple months before I got clean and for some reason stuck it out with me, literally cannot watch ID Channel. She has PTSD from the announcers on it because, like, it brings back this time that I literally would just sit up all night watching ID Channel. And she can't allow. She does not allow those crime shows on at night anymore because she's like, I can't do it. Like, that's so. That was a terrible time.
Yeah.
And also during that time, like, it was the end of the run. My fiance had just met me. She had no idea I was an addict because I was really, really good at hiding it. And, like, I would just, like, disappear and I would say I was, like, at work or, like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, there's always an excuse. Huh?
Yeah, so. My parents finally were like, listen, like. This Something's can't go. Give. Yeah, this can't go on. Like, you can't live here and do all this. Like, you just can't do it. Like, we're not going to allow it. Like, that's why I think they finally talked to someone. They were like, "Listen, you're enabling him, you idiots. Like, stop doing all this. Like, you're really, like, making things worse for him." And that's exactly what they did. They confronted me. My mom was never really good at it because I could kind of brush her off, but she was always disciplinary. It's really weird. But my dad, like, my dad family has a big history of addiction. He's lost his older brother, his nephew, and his dad all died as a direct result of this disease. Mm. And he kind of like, he never brought it with him, but he like seeing it in his son crushed him. And yeah. that's kind of what did it to me. Mm. Is seeing my dad absolutely like devastated, like trying to talk to me while I'm laying in my bed high as hell. Just like, he's cut off all my credit cards at this point. Mm-hmm. He's cut off my money. I literally have nothing. I have no way to get more. I literally am out of money. I yeah. have no way to get more. I have nothing to sell. Mm-hmm. Nothing to give up. I'm done. I know, like, what I have left is what I have. And yeah. and I know, like, I was like, all right. So that night, I brushed him off. Mm-hmm. And I was so devastated that I had, like, at this point, I was taking basically about 100, anywhere from like 50 to 110 milligram Percocets a day. So I was up there like 500 to 1,000 milligrams of Percocet a day. So my habit was ridiculous.
Wow.
Like I couldn't go like 30 to 40 yet. Minutes without taking one. Like yeah. I was like so messed up, I'd go straight into withdrawal. So I was taking so many of them at like, I only had, I think it was like 17, 10 milligram Percocets left.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like, all right, well, this is it. So mm-hmm. I crush all of them up and I literally go like, and I don't know if it was an active choice. I was like, I'm going to take these all at once. If I die, I die. Like, I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm cool. Like, it's whatever. Yeah. At this point, like, I have nothing left to live for.
Mm-hmm.
But if I wake up the next morning, I'll give this thing a shot. I'll give recovery a shot. I'll do what my parents say. I'll be done.
That's I'll one do way whatever to do it. Yeah.
Whatever I had. So that's kind of what I did. I took all these in one go, and I woke up the next morning. And at that point in time, it wasn't even like next morning. It was like I woke up like 2 hours later. I was like, damn it. and so I knew because I was already going to go into withdrawal. My head was already like, mm-hmm. my anxiety was already coming up. Like I'd already started getting like the yeah. pre-sweats.
Oh, yeah.
And so I told my parents, okay, I'll go to inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And so problem is, we like call my insurance, and my insurance goes, well, you haven't ever been hospitalized from an overdose, so we can't pay for inpatient. And they literally what? Said
Whoa.
That. They said, you can do IOP. And I basically sent them paperwork saying he's been kicked out of IOP 3 times. My IOP counselor called the insurance and said, no, we can't take him. Like
yeah.
he's literally like, this doesn't have, he needs inpatient. My insurance was like, well, one of the check boxes is you need to be hospitalized for an overdose in order for us to pay for inpatient.
What?
Wow.
And so my parents reached out, and luckily,
God bless insurance companies.
This is where, yeah, I hate insurance companies more than anything. But this is also where that same pattern came in, that them reaching in to save me actually did save me, mm-hmm. like more than anything. So they had the monetary means to send me to one of the best like dual diagnosis rehabs in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there for 45 days. But the problem is it took like 3 days to get there. And I didn't want to be.
Where was it?
Karen in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Mm.
So it was really good rehab. So then my smart self, I'm such a genius. Like, I have incredible IQ. I was like, well, I don't want to be detoxed when I'm in this like rehab. Like,
mm-hmm.
like, I don't want to be feeling sick when I'm away from home. I'd rather feel sick in my bed. So, like, after I took this massive dose of Percocets, like, I think it was only, like, 5 hours afterwards. And then, like, after I'd been on a huge bender, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to precipitate my withdrawal. And I took, like, 2 Suboxone 8 milligram strips.
Mm.
And this was only, like, 4 or 5 hours. I have never been so sick in my entire life. And I've done precipitated withdrawal before.
Mm.
But I'd never done it, like, so soon after such a big hit.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the issue. And it just, I lost it. This is the first and only time I've ever had panic attacks in my life. At that point in time, it was so bad. And my parents couldn't get me into rehab for 3 days. So I basically had to detox at their house. They basically just... Oof. Every hour on the hour, I was just laying in a bathtub naked, like, with the shower pouring over me, trying to regulate my temperature, because I was so, like, the sweats and the chills were so bad that, like, they would be setting off the panic attacks.
Mm.
And it was so bad, my anxiety was so bad, because at this point, like, my anxiety had been so bad because I made that decision
yeah.
that, like, my body was so, and my mind was kind of rebelling from that decision, like, no, 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 this is bad, like, so I was panicking.
Yeah.
So, I actually, at this one point in time, my dad's sitting in the bathroom, me, I'm 20... I guess 26 years old at this point. 27 years old? No, 26 years old. 26 years old, yeah. No, I just turned 27. So I'm 27 years old, laying naked in the bathtub. I have, like, a little washcloth covering me up. My dad's, like, trying to, like, calm me down because I'm slamming my head into the wall because I'm panicking. And I'm asking my dad, who's, like, I'm his firstborn child, to kill me. I'm asking my dad to kill me. He's, like, I'm just, like, I can't go through this. Just kill me, Dad. Like, I'm done. And, like, finally... Like, I completely destroyed my parents. Like, yeah. I finally, like, they had to sit with this and watch this. And then I had to call my then girlfriend and, like, invite her over and be like, this is where I've been. I'm actually an addict. Like, you just, the reason why I kept going to the bathroom for, like, an hour at a time every time I was with you is because I was actually snorting Percocets in there. Just so you know, I'm going off to rehab. You should probably leave me. And as you can see, my fiance is sitting here right now. She didn't leave me. She went on this journey with me. I don't know why. I told her at least 20 times during those, like, day before I went to rehab to leave.
Literally makes her, like, a million times more amazing.
Yeah, I literally said, you should probably run away. Like, you have no idea the hell that's going to be coming right now.
Wow.
So I precipitate my withdrawal. I go off to rehab. Rehab is, rehab.
Yeah.
45 days. I actually...
Eric loves rehab.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, rehab was, like, is nice. Like, the so I slept, like, the first 2 weeks, like, because I had just been...
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I slept. They make you go to group there. They make you, like, go to participate. And I would just nod out in group because I was just, like, I was done. Like,
body was fucked.
My body had been fucked. I've been running on, like, an hour of sleep for, like, a year straight. Everything was getting reset.
Oh, yeah.
And the one, like... The amazing thing about being from a good family is when I made the decision to go to rehab, I wasn't the only one to make that decision. My entire family jumped headfirst into recovery.
Nice.
My parents still, they're now like co-facilitators of like a parent support group up at the long-term rehab that I went to after Karen.
Nice.
And they go every week and they help, they reach out to multiple parents of like friends of people that we know and basically saying like trying to like teach them about enabling and how it hurts and doesn't help and like what you can do to help. They've really like jumped headfirst into recovery. And that's like the amazing part of coming from like such a good family is it's not like, when I entered recovery, I didn't enter it alone. And that was the coolest part. I told my girlfriend at that time to leave me and run. When she came up for like family education weekend, when we all had to sit around and tell basically everyone tell me how horrible like I treated them. So I got understood the consequences.
Yeah.
Like everyone asked her, like, why are you here? Like you've only been with him like 3 months. Like leave him. Like you have no idea what you're in store for.
Yeah.
And she's a stubborn Jewish woman and just didn't want to go.
She must have fucking liked you or something.
She's
saying she hates him right now.
Yeah, so we just so I get through there, my 28 days is up, and I actually say, like, I slept for the first like 10 days, like, can I stay? And my parents are like, yeah, like, let's. And I talked to a counselor and they're like, we talked over, so I ended up staying like 45 total days in like inpatient setting. I finally started getting like my energy back. I started doing it, and so a lot of people I knew when I was an inpatient were like, oh, yeah, we're going to, like, sober houses, and we can go back right back into the workforce. So I met my counselor. I was like, yeah, this is an amazing place in, like, Tinley Square in D.C. There's a Tinley house. It's awesome. Like, I know some people that are going there, mm-hmm. and he's like, no. Like, you're an opiate addict who's literally been using opiates every single day for about a decade. Like, you do not need to go right back into a recovery house. You need to go long-term treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And... he gave me two options. One had just opened up in Maryland. The other one had been a little more... one had just opened up, like, closer to my home, and the other one has been, like, a little more established, but they're both, like, long-term treatment places. So he showed those to my parents, and that's when I lost, basically, the decision. They kind of let me have the decision, but it really wasn't, like... They were like, listen, like... this is what we recommend. We really think we should take the therapy.
It was like a recovery suggestion. Like, you should probably fucking
do this. Yeah, it's just like, this is what the therapist says. And like, at this point, they're like, you agreed. Like, you're going to do whatever anybody says. Like, like, you agreed to this.
Yeah.
So I did. And so basically for 6 months on my first year in recovery, I was in treatment. I actually was asked to leave the treatment house because I don't like following rules very well. I was getting a little rebellious to Zen and kind of my old behaviors kind of and I just didn't like being told what to do 24/7. And
yeah,
they didn't really they really didn't like it that I kept sneaking in phones and like talking to people.
Yeah.
So they basically asked me to leave. I was one of the first patients at this treatment center. So it was kind of like building as we went along. And if it had been established, I probably would have been asked to leave like months earlier.
Yeah.
But so I was asked to leave, and that was like, that was a make or break it time for me in recovery. I'd gotten involved in 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. I'd been involved in treatment. I did like the whole like getting my life back together. I got a sponsor. I was working steps.
Mm-hmm.
But my entitlement and my sense of like taking my will back was happening right then in that long-term treatment center. And the best thing that ever happened to me was being kicked out. And yeah. I know what happened when I got kicked out is they called my parents and said that he's not allowed back.
Ooh.
And my parents, I told you, they jump headfirst in recovery. You want to know what they finally stopped doing? They stopped enabling. So they didn't allow me. They allowed me back that night. And they said, after that, you got to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily for me, I had good friends in the 12-step program. They said, we can get you into a house, like the very next day, recovery house. But it's on Hartford Road.
Yeah.
So little white boy from Columbia goes down to Hartford Road.
Yeah.
And this is a very different type of recovery than I'd been used to before.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been on West Side, kind of upper middle class recovery,
yeah.
Howard County recovery, like really high end treatment center recovery.
Yeah.
Now I'm in the gutters. Yeah. I'm down now on Hartford Road.
Mm-hmm. You're Baltimore recovery
I'm
now.
I'm literally in the middle of like all the treatment centers. Or not all the treatment centers, all the like the
war zones.
Yeah, the really cheap like recovery houses that like not cheap, but like the recovery houses where you can leave the recovery house and go walk to the corner that you were using on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
I was no longer the entitled brat. Like I was scared.
Yeah.
I felt fear for the first time like in a long like since the initial treatment center. I felt like actual fear when I had to leave my parents' house that next morning and drive to the recovery house in the middle of Baltimore where I didn't know anybody, and I had to start over again because my entitlement and my behaviors acted up.
Yeah.
And that was a big turning point for me. I had to. So then my sponsor, like, one of the big things that I had with me is my, like, pretentiousness and my entitlement. Like,
mm-hmm.
I kind of come off that way sometimes. And I feel that way sometimes. And that was one of my character defects. One of the things he said is, like, you need a recovery job. Mm-hmm. So here I am. I have a master's from Johns Hopkins. And I am washing cars at a car dealership
for
those 6 months clean.
I couldn't do that.
I'm getting paid literally minimum
wage.
That's
because you're bougie, Eric. Fuck you.
I'm getting paid literally minimum wage in a freezing conditions to wash cars at a Ford dealership that I got through a guy in recovery. Oh,
good on you, man.
And I did it. I sucked it up. I said, this is my suggestion. This is what I have to do. Like, you want to know what? Like, I'm going to pay for my own way. Like, of course, my parents were helping me out a little bit with rent for the recovery house because they agreed with they agreed with my sponsor. They agreed, like, you've been given everything on a silver platter. Everything in your life, and this is one of the statements that I make when I'm sharing 12-step meetings or anything like that, is, like, everything in my life up until recovery was easy for me. I got straight A's without even doing homework. I played college soccer without even really trying. I smoked weed the entire time while I was playing, but I was good. When it came to regulating my emotions and seeing who Andrew was and becoming happy with Andrew and giving recovery a shot, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
Wow.
I've never had a challenge like this before. Like, I had, like, minuscule challenge, like, setting goals and stuff like that. But I never really had to try hard. I was kind of like the things were gifted to me. And I was gifted, like, different things. And then recovery came along, and I didn't know how to work hard.
Yeah.
And that showed up in that long-term recovery center. That's why I became entitled. That's why I came out and started acting the way I did. But once, like, I got kicked in the teeth and said, get out, like, I wasn't getting things my own way. I couldn't go back to my parents. They were done enabling me. They learned.
Yeah.
And so then I had to go, and my only option available to me was go over in these gutters, learn how to be the addict that helps the other addict, learn how to give rides, learn how to go to meetings, chase meetings every single night, work a job that I was dead tired every day because I'd never done manual labor in my life. Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
If the definition of white collar, you go in there, there's a picture of me. And
yeah.
Then,
yeah.
So I'm having to do these manual labor jobs. I'm living in the gutters. I'm living in like a room shared, but I'm living in a basement that breaks every single fire code to the point when fire inspectors come, you actually have to hide the beds. I'm not even joking about that.
That's awesome.
And there's like four of us down there, but I loved it. I got to like, I got to see like how lucky I am to have a second chance at life, to see how lucky I am to like I don't know if I ever would have, like, made it if I had switched circumstances with someone else. If someone else was, like, from, like, a Dundalk or a place like that who didn't have the resources, didn't have the family that I have, like, I got to feel, like, grateful. That was my first bit of gratefulness, and that was, like, a huge part of it. And, like, overcoming the entitlement and the pretentiousness was to feel the gratefulness of, like, being able to see where I came from, see how lucky I am. So I spent the last, like, 6 months of that working, doing cars, living in a recovery center, recovery house, and then I got offered a job with one of my sponsee brothers, selling medical equipment, and the money was good. So I was just like, all right, well, let's take a step up. I talked to my sponsor. He's like, yeah, like, you're obviously, like, smart enough. You can handle this. Like, let's take a step up. You've done a recovery job. You've done everything you asked for me. And, like, I was doing recovery just like I did school. I was, like, running through steps, like, doing all the work. He slowed me down on 4 and 5, but my recovery is just such a culmination of, like, rehabs, familial and
external
support, like, and then also 12-step programs. And I'm not the biggest meeting maker when it comes to 12-step programs, but the most important part for me that I, like, and one of the parts that, like, because I kind of, like, based on my, like, schooling and stuff like that, I kind of look at the psychological aspect of it, is, like, the cohesion and support. And I was able to change around. Like, I'm still friends. Like, so I have a group of, like, 5 friends I've been friends with, like, since I've been in kindergarten. We went through school all the way through. And I'm still close with those guys, but we don't hang out the way we do. We have, like, a group chat. I talk to them. They all understand where I'm at. They completely agree. One of the other ones definitely should be with me, but he hasn't reached there yet. And they completely understand. They're very supportive. But my entire, like, daily support life has changed. I'm now, like, have a big group of guys that are all in recovery. That is my social circle now. And that's, like, everything my parents wanted. My parents are very happy for me. And just, like, I mean, that's the important part, is, like, this whole step of journey was based on, like, building up and, like, creating this new life. And a lot of the cliches they say, like, I get sick of them. And a lot of times, like, I still get very, like, prejudicial and judgmental when I listen to other people share. Because a lot of times I see their behaviors and it's not matching up to their talking. And, like, kind of my pretentiousness and entitlement comes out. And I end up, like, judging them, like, on the stand. But then I have to, like, remind myself where I came from. And that's why I have those guys where they check me. They check me in place and let me not get too far. And, but, yeah, that's basically the cliches about, like, having to change it. The only thing you have to change is everything. It's completely true, because, like, I had to change my area, I had to change my group of friends, I had to change my job path. I had to, like, start everything over, which was good for me. I was able to start from the bottom, work jobs that I never would have worked if I continued up. I now have my family, like, completely supportive in my life. They're very proud of me. Text me all the time. I still engage in therapy, which I think is, especially based on my career path, is extremely beneficial. I think therapy is one of the most important things. I'm engaged to get married. I have a lovely fiance. I have great friends. I'm back involved in soccer again, but I play, like, rec now. I don't take it seriously. I try not to get hurt. And when I do get hurt, last year I did a really bad ankle injury. I tore the ligament off the bone to the point that it took bone with it and chipped bone. I was in a boot for 3 months. Luckily, I have the support, and I was able to do it without any painkillers.
Nice.
I have really bad luck with it.
Dude, why are you still playing,
Jesus,
man?
Dude.
Because I love it.
I understand.
Start playing ping pong or darts, man. You gotta scale your shit back.
But that was really bad, but I had the support. I had my fiance, who worked in an orthopedics office then, go with me and just be like, listen, like, I'm going to feel the urge not to check off substance abuse on this thing. I need you to make sure I check this off and tell them that I'm an opiate addict.
Throughout this story, it's very obvious she is the better half.
Oh, without a doubt, she's the better, like, half, three quarters, and 90% of us.
You act like I didn't take him to my doctor's for a reason.
Nice.
So, well, all right. I think that's about what I got right now.
Cool, man.
All right.
Hopefully that was long enough.
No, it was good.
Oh, yeah.
You did great.
Now we got some fucking questions for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to start.
You can start.
I can start. Thank you.
Fine.
Thank you, Eric. All right. So Eric coined something the other day that I had never heard and really applies to you. What Eric said is that, like, throughout his addiction, he failed upwards. Like, shit would go wrong, but for some reason, his life would still improve. And, like, how applicable is that to, like, your addiction story?
I think it's incredibly applicable. I think the best part, the best example of that was I was getting my master's at Johns Hopkins, and I was getting straight A's. I'm leaving classes to snort Percocet and go back. And even to the point that my last semester there, one of the classes that I failed, I was actually assistant to the dean of the program. She'd actually handpicked me to help teach. I was, like, the only master's TA in the program. And I was actually teaching in a master's course intro to counseling for her. And I just stopped showing up teaching it. And that was one of the classes, so it was like a special project that I actually, she didn't even fail me on. She just gave me an incomplete because she was like, I don't even know what happened. You just stopped showing up.
Yes.
And when I had to like apply for reinstatement, I actually had to talk to her because she was still the dean. Like, listen, like, I'm so sorry. Like, and I ended up telling her the truth. I ended up telling her, like, I was an opiate addict. I was seriously addicted to Percocet through that whole time. And being how she's the dean of a clinical psychology program, she kind of understood. She was very empathetic. And she was like, yeah, I just had no idea what happened. She was, she actually, so to get, when you fail two classes, they, you get automatically kicked out, especially at
a university like Hopkins. Yeah.
So to get back in, you actually have to petition the vice dean of the entire university.
Yeah.
And basically they don't accept very many. Like they don't, they don't allow you back in. But my dean, that I stopped showing up for her, that she failed me.
She went to bat for you.
She went to bat with me, the vice dean, and explained it. And I, she said, basically, tell the truth. So I told the truth to the vice dean. I told the vice dean, I'm an addict. I'm an addict in recovery. I have 3 years clean right now. Or at that point, I was a little less than 3 years clean right now. I started this program. You could see from my grades. I have two Fs, and I have a 3.8 GPA.
Yeah.
And that's like, I was like, you could see when I showed up, I was good. And I am a credit, and like you can see, I never had any disciplinary problems. I always showed up. I always do what I asked. I have good grades. Like, but I'm an addict, and I'm in recovery now. Like, and I stopped showing up. There's no excuse for me stopping showing up. I just want to explain my story and basically fall on your mercy. And she said,
"You failed upwards.
You're back in."
Son of a bitch. Just a quick fuck you to both of you, because I failed fucking downwards. I failed hard downwards. Oh,
I just got kind of luck of the draw. And like, well, then my, that's kind of my life. It's like, I was always like, felt like I was less than, but in reality, like when I look back with a clean and like new kind of empathetic perspective, it's just like,
I just got such a huge resentment against both of you.
That's fine. You can be resentful all you want. I'll still fail upwards.
Damn.
So, yeah, and that's like kind of the same thing as I kind of lucked out.
Sick burn.
Yeah, I lucked out in my life. And,
yeah.
That's what I was saying earlier. Like, things just came easy for me, exceptional recovery. And you fail downwards, I just luck out.
Yeah.
Luck of the Irish, bro.
Fuck me, right? Yeah. All right. So, since coming into recovery, how has your addiction manifested into your life?
It's definitely manifested in different ways. I definitely substitute addictions a lot of times.
Oh, yeah.
I never smoked cigarettes, vaped, or anything like that, because I was really into like sports and stuff like that.
Never.
I started smoking my second week into rehab.
Yeah, of course.
And I started dipping like crazy. I started vaping. So now, and like there was at one point, I was actually like, there would be times I would have a dip and I'd be smoking and have a vape in my hand too.
Oh my god!
And so like my tobacco addiction went like crazy. My nicotine addiction.
Nicotine.
I really didn't do a lot of caffeine drinks either. Because I was kind of into like soccer, and so like I drink a Red Bull every now and then, but then like it got to the point where I was drinking like Spike energy drinks like twice a day and stuff like that.
That's really common amongst addicts. And fucking energy
so
drinks.
So the other thing is like I get really stubborn, hard headed, like emotional regulation. Like it comes out like especially with like fights with my fiance and stuff like that. Where
is,
I just
is
really
this true? Get, is this true?
I'm just gonna
sit
really.
Wow. Yeah, that's a resounding yes.
Yeah, you get like kind of stubborn, and you even if you know you're wrong, you're not going to admit it, at least for the next day or so. And then, obviously, like, I like to get outside myself. A lot of people turn to, like, gambling or porn or stuff like that, but I really enjoy video games. And so, like, I have to, like, constantly check myself and make sure I'm not spending too much time on, because, like...
What game are you on right now?
Call of Duty Black Ops.
All right.
So,
four?
Yeah.
The newest.
Yeah, me and, like, actually another dude that we're both really close with in the program.
Is it Nathan?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Nathan.
Yeah, we literally play every day.
Nice. Cool. Nathan,
with each other.
Nathan, pay attention to your wife.
She said he's actually been doing well lately, but he's still on with me every night.
I'm sure.
but yeah, so like that's and one of the things like I try to explain to my fiance a lot is just like with my like brain and my addict type thinking, like just sitting there and watching TV or just like sitting there and just like zoning out, my brain's always still going. I need something to like occupy my hands, my eyes, my brain, everything, so I can get outside of myself. That's like my only like emotional regulation at this point. Like it's my way of shutting off. I don't have booze. I don't have weed. I don't have all the things I used to rely on. And so this is one of the things. So like I actually came up with a term for it, and all the guys I've ever told it to really enjoy it. I call it decompression time. So literally I come home from work and I tell her I need decompression time, give her a whole psychological explanation for it. The reason why, like, I work hard, like I'm an addict, I need this time to kind of unwind and stuff like that. It sounds great. It sounds
like you're a clinical bullshit artist.
It sounds like a term right out of the clinical licks book. And so like I told it, so Nathan started using it with Molly.
Sons of bitches.
My dentist started using it with his wife. Like any person I tell decompression time literally uses it for it. And so like actually to the point that like I went in to get a bunch of like fillings done, and he wrote me a doctor's note to give to Allie that Andrew gets decompression time.
Oh wow, god, you're a master manipulator. All right, I know Eric's clamoring because he has a whole list of questions. It's you're up.
Okay, let's see here. First off, yes, story great, most relatable person I've heard probably ever actually. So
you're welcome, Eric.
Yeah, most relatable.
I picked
honestly,
a great one. I got a great one. Thank you.
So let's see. We'll start with the surgery. So I'm on, I guess I won't count the appendicitis, but for knees and legs, I'm like five surgeries deep. So, you know, oxy, you know, started young, right?
Yeah.
So do you believe, you know, and you said you had, you know, you were drinking, smoking, stuff like that. Do you think that was really the jump start, like the kick that really took your addiction to like a whole new level when you shattered your meniscus?
I think it was a combination of factors. I think that was changed because I had learned about like snorting the Percocet beforehand before I injured it.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had done it like recreationally, as much as you can recreationally use opiates in college. Yeah. So like I had it like my freshman year, like before I'd injured it, like it kind of showed up. This was like my big experimental phase. So I had tried it before, but I think the availability of it really stepped up to a whole new level where I was doing it constantly. And that's like came to a point where I started like not just there's that you think about it, and especially having like my sophomore year of college, that there's a change in like mindset. So my freshman year of college and like before in high school, when you got drugs, you couldn't wait to tell your friends to share it and like have fun with it, stuff like that. There's that change of mindset that happens in every addict's life where they go, I'm not going to tell them anymore. I don't want to share. Wow. There's that change in mindset where you go like, oh my god, I just found this sweet connect. I have all this weed, dudes, let's go smoke it. To, I'm going to tell them I only have a gram and I have like an eighth.
I have never thought of that before.
Every single addict has a change in mindset that switches from sharing to others and experimenting and doing like that to there at some point in time in their life, they switch off to hoarding and hiding.
That happened when I was 19.
That 100%. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I've heard it in every single story I've ever. There becomes a point where they were social. They wanted to share it to the point where they're not telling their friends that they have it, and they're only using it for themselves to the point like they'll go hide and use it and come back out to their friends and pretend like they don't have it.
Well, that's what bathrooms are for.
Holy shit.
Every addict has a switch of mentality, something like that. I've always noticed it.
Wow. Dude, you. Wow, you just mind fucked me.
It's amazing we spend 8 years studying psychology and become an addict, what you can think of.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Like, you kind of think about it, and, like, I tend to think in thought patterns. Like, I think about, like, what happens. Like, so, like I said earlier, it's, like, what kind of assessments can we give kids to determine who's going to become an addict to kind of, like, help prevent this opioid epidemic?
Yeah.
And so, like, the behaviors that I've noticed, like, and so I sit in 12-step meetings and I listen to stories and I think about, so what behaviors are they exhibiting as, like, young teenagers, adolescents, kids? And the one thing I notice is, like, the lying and exaggerated behavior.
Yeah.
That's, like, the common. And then also that switch where they stop being social with the drugs and stuff like that and start hoarding and hiding.
Wow.
Cool. So next, before we get to a video game question,
of course.
Okay, so I'm a workaholic for sure, 100%. Like, even when you were just talking about working 40 hours a week, going to school, and, you know, doing drugs, I was like, that sounds amazing. Like, I think back on those times where I'm like doing like, you know, 18 credits and like working 50 hours and still using actively, like, and I'm just like,
I was able to kill it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just, you know, do you, so I don't know how much you work now, or, you know, you probably have slowed down, but like, do you still, I mean, that rush of the working part and like the school grind and that sort of stuff. I don't know. What do you like? I don't know where I'm going with that.
No, I understand where you. I understand where you're going. There's definitely been a change in mindset, and there's one of the things that I was so like, I had so much fear inside of me getting back into school because I was like, what if I can't do it? Since freshman mm-hmm. year of college, I have literally self-medicated every single day throughout doing it. I had so much fear in going back to school. I was like, what if I get? I mean, I definitely have ADHD.
Yeah.
Like, and I had always self-medicated with opioids and weed. Like, I would literally take, like, I'd mix Adderall, like an Oxy 30, and a bong hit, grind it up, snort it, take the bong hit, and then I could type for hours. Mm-hmm. And I would just type papers. I could crush out, like, 20-page papers in a night. And I was like, I can't do, like, I can't do those anymore. I can't rely on them. I'm not going to go back and get a stimulant because I don't want to, like, say, like, I've been surviving without it for this long. Like,
yeah.
So I was really scared about doing it. Turns out I still can. I'm still getting really good grades. I actually overwrite everything now, which is, I'm not as succinct as I used to be. I literally do run on sentences and my mind kind of wanders, but I'm able to do the work.
Probably all that fucking Molly.
Oh my God, my mind's screwed. That was one of the things like that I was like scared of. Like, also the fear was, is like my mind, like I was scared my mind wasn't going to get back to what it used to be. My mind used to be like really, really good. Mm-hmm. I was really good testing and stuff like that. And like, I scored really high on all standardized tests. I used to like kill it. And I was worried my mind was fucked. Yeah. I was worried. I took so many drugs that my mind was never going to recover.
Yeah.
And it hasn't in some ways. My memory's not nearly what it used to be.
Yeah.
But I'm still able to do my work and still able to figure stuff out. And that's kind of the big part about it. But yeah, I have the grind for school, but I don't have like the, it's not as much, I don't have the motivation as much anymore. I really have to like kind of time management and like say I can play video games for this long, but I got to do school like this night, this night, this night. I'd never miss work. I'm always early. I always, and I'll stay late anytime I have to. I never like, so there's still that aspect of it. I think if you're later than 15 minutes early, then you're late to work. So I like showing up early. I like staying. I do my job very well. But I'm also at the point where I'm almost doing the next job. Like, I'm almost back to where I wanted to be by finishing up my program and about to get my license.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I'm kind of excited for the next step too. So I'm kind of in between right now. But.
Cool, man.
You gonna do the last stock question?
No.
You're not?
Not.
What the fuck?
What, the step question?
Yeah.
Have you worked, you've worked all the steps?
I am on, currently, I just finished step 11. I'm on step 12 right now, but he told me I have to get like a new H&I when I'm not comfortable. Because I was taking H&I into the rehab I went to.
Wow, that's so, very comfortable.
So he says you're too comfortable with doing that. So he wants me to get H&I somewhere I hadn't been before and actually like, go through a certain amount of time bringing it in there.
Okay.
So I've done all the steps up to 12.
So before I ask what your favorite step is, do you type out your steps?
We do old school steps. We don't do it on the step board, you guys.
Oh, okay.
So like my sponsorship family is full of people with like 30 years, stuff like that, that are byproducts from one 12-step fellowship to a newer 12-step fellowship. So they
the kinda, sober fellowship to the clean fellowship?
Yes. So they started out there and they brought over the old school way of doing it. So like step one, we didn't write, we didn't type it out. What we did is we listed 10 ways we were powerless over our addiction and 10 ways our life became unmanageable. And then we discussed. And we sat down for a couple hours with our sponsor and we discussed it. And like, and so like, one of my favorite things that he had to do is like step three. I had to make a oh my god, I can't remember what it was. It's called like a God box. Anytime something bothered me, anytime something bothered me, I'd write it down, shove it in a God box, and after a couple months, we'd open it up, and he'd be like, "Does this bother you anymore?" I'd be like, "No." He's like, "Look, you don't need to turn it over." And it was kind of like 3 months worth of problems. It was really cool. But by far, my favorite step with them was step four and step five. I think that's... And one of the things I hear in meetings is, like, you don't really see people that have serious recovery not get by step four and step five.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because so step four, the old school way, is we wrote our life story.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't... We wrote literally entire life story. Mine ended up being, like, 47 pages type, single space.
Good God, man.
And step five was we read it with our sponsor, and
you should publish that. That'd be pretty groovy.
Yeah, and then the end of step five is we deleted it and we burned it.
Yeah, that is the old school. Yeah, that is the old school way.
So that was like those two steps combined really like, because I was so, it wasn't that I was like scared, but you're so apprehensive to share such intimate details about yourself. Like up till then, like 1, 2, 3, you like share yourself with your sponsor, but you don't let them in. Like, this is the nitty gritty shit I am so embarrassed about that I did. And that's kind of like the point of 4 and 5 is they tell you, like, give it all away. Like, share it. And when you share it and your sponsor goes like, oh, that's not that bad. Here, that is something just like that. Blah, blah, blah.
It's such a huge weight
off.
And
it's just, you feel like, I'm not a loser. Like, I'm not, like, I'm, there's other people like me. And I feel like at that point in time, your bond with your sponsor grows. And because of that, because you trust your sponsor, then your bond with your fellows grow. Because you learn that one guy in the program can still love me for who I am. Why not let these other guys know who I am?
Yeah.
Before that, I think I felt like I had a little shield up. But after that, I think that was, like, the point where I started not just, like, being close to my sponsor, sponsor failing, but I let down my, like, shields and started talking with other guys in the program.
Nice. Cool. Okay. I got one final question.
Okay.
All right. So you said like pretension is, and I guess arrogance is one of your
entitlement. Yeah.
Entitlement is one of your big character aspects.
Yeah.
How has that changed since coming into recovery? Sort of seeing people of not so affluent nature. Like, how has it been difficult? How have you bonded with addicts who didn't have it like the way you had it?
So, like, one of the things I have to check myself on is I'm comparing out. Like,
yeah.
I'm not going to be able to go in and be like, listen, like, I didn't shoot heroin straight into my, like, jugular dick vein. Like, that just didn't do it. Like, but what I can relate to is how they felt when they did it. The feeling that nothing else could make them feel better. And when it comes down to it, the thing that bonds better than anything else is, like, helping out other addicts. And that's what I kind of found is, like, when I was on the Hartford Road house is there was a group of us that actually bonded, like, really bonded, one from Dundalk, one from out Carroll County, one was from Pikesville, who was actually one of my really close friends during that initial time of recovery, and he's basically a vegetable at this point.
Oh,
because he never really, I'm sure you know, but, so, yeah, it's just, like, you kind of bond and going to meetings and chasing it, and, like, when you're in early recovery, it's, like, and then once you get a little bit later in recovery, it's, like, you, all type of people show up to help the rest of your, like, common group.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of all, of course, like, I tend to, like, I still sometimes go to meetings on a Hartford Road, but it's usually a special occasion, anniversary, stuff like that. But I tend to fall back into my comfort zone and go to meetings, like, Upper West Side, stuff like that, where people that are, like, more common to where I come from. But that doesn't mean I feel any uncomfortable. I still, one of my favorite meetings to this day is down the Sunday night meeting at Northwest Hospital. And this is complete opposite from where I've been as, like, possibly.
Yeah.
And it's, those guys are so loving, and, like, I still have guys that call me from that, and I just love going in there because it's such a different type of recovery, and it kind of gives me, like, a nice little jolt back when I'm feeling, like, a little bit entitled and stuff like that. So I just try to keep that active in my program.
All right. Well, cool. That's all we got. It's great. Well,
thanks, man. Dude, you fucking killed
it. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Any last words for any final message for the addicts out there?
No, just, I mean, I think the most important part is building your support network. I mean, getting friends.
100%.
Yeah, I agree.
I think if you try to go at this alone, you will not, like, it'll be really hard to succeed. But if you have, like, people you can rely on, like, my best friend in the program, we literally talk to each other every day at 5 p.m. when we both get off work. We call each other. We let each other know. Like, before, I'd only ever done that with girls.
Is that Nathan?
Yeah, of course it is. And then we set up our video game schedule for the night.
Oh, of course.
But every single day, we talk to each other, and we check in, and we curse out our wives or fiancés, and we see how ridiculous they're being. But it's the truth. I mean, that's our venting. And if I didn't have that, I would bottle it up.
Yep.
And if I bottled it up, eventually I would turn to something else to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And having that as an outlet, having friends, having a sponsor, like, that's what makes it worthwhile. Life without friends, without, like, people that you care about, I mean, it's not really life.
So. Pretty lonely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again. Anything else?
No.
All right.
No. Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for coming.
Did a great job, man. Here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. All right. Well, thank you, Eric. Thank you, Andrew. Everybody, all our listeners, thanks for listening. Go to podcastrecovery.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter. Like, share, subscribe, blah, 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 all that good stuff. Thanks for listening. Catch us next week. Stay safe and stay clean.